nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so today I want to go on to the next topic, sort of. That, as you know, what we have been talking about the last few classes is this general semi-classical way of thinking for the dynamics. That is, when an electron goes from one contact to another, as you mentioned, there are two kinds of evolved. One is what you might call a dynamical evolution, where it's obeying something like Newton's law. And then there are scattering processes, which are kind of random. And in a ballistic device, it goes from one contact to another by a purely dynamical process. And then whatever scattering is at the ends then. But in long devices, there are all kinds of scattering processes in between. And we are now, in this context, what we are trying to talk about, discuss is how to think of this dynamical part, that how electrons move from one point to another in a solid. And as we discussed, that one way of thinking about it, the semi-classical way of thinking, is that you write this total energy, kinetic energy plus potential energy. And as you know, there's this Newton's law, which says the momentum changes according to the force. And there is the equivalent of that. There's the, I guess, the generalization of that that we discussed before with this dx dt. I think we wrote, if I remember, dx dt is equal to 1 over h bar del E del K, and of course this momentum is like h bar k, and then we had h bar dk dt, and that's equal to minus del E del X, right? And you could generalize this to three dimensions and all that. Now, this is the form that's often called this Hamilton's equations of motion. That's in equivalent to Newton's laws, but in a more generalizable format. Okay. Now, when you go to the wave version, that is, this you're thinking of electrons as particles. It has got a position and a momentum which evolve with time in a certain way, and that's this. This tells you how the position evolves. This tells you how the momentum evolves. Now, in quantum mechanics, of course, instead of that, you have this wave equation, the Schrodinger wave equation. And the principle is, to get from here to here, the energy is replaced by IH bar ddt, momentum is replaced by minus IH bar ddx. That's the new equation. And what you can show is that if you had slowly varying potentials, u here, and in the limit, let's think of something as constant, then a wave packet obeying Schrodinger equation would sort of move as if it's following this Newton's laws. That is, if we, for example, did this numerically, like we have a solid, let's say a one-dimensional solid, and we set up a little wave packet someplace. This is X. And then watched it evolve in time according to this Schrodinger's wave equation. If you did that, then what you'd see is that the wave packet, the center of the wave packet, would be moving according to that first equation, dx dt equals this. What that means is, if the wave packet you have constructed with k's such that del E del K, that group velocity, is actually positive. As you know, this E versus K looks something like this. And around here, all the states have a positive dE dK, so they have a positive velocity. Anything here has a negative velocity. So if you construct wave packets by taking states from here, then it will move in this direction. If you take them from here, it will move in the other direction, etc. Now, this is something that in somewhere in freshman physics, you talk about this group velocity, the idea that an envelope moves with this velocity. But the best way to convince yourself these days, I'd say, is this is something one can simulate easily on a computer and actually see how it moves. You see, that's the best way to almost convince oneself that a wave packet really moves with that velocity. Okay? And that's something, I guess, in the next homework, you know, I'll try to tell you, you know, how to do that, and you could work this out. Now, in order to do it numerically on a computer, usually, always, what you do is not quite work with a differential equation, but with a matrix version of it. That is and that's the connection I want to explain today, because differential equations like this are good, are very convenient for analytical solutions, in the sense that there are many problems where you can write down a solution analytically. You can write down a psi as a function of x and t, which you can then show will actually satisfy this differential equation. So if you have a nice analytical solution, then differential equations are very convenient. So for example, the hydrogen atom. In that case, this U has a particular form, and Schrodinger showed back in 1925 that when you solve this equation for the allowed energy levels, they exactly match what people see in experiments. And that's, of course, what convinced everyone at that stage that there was something right about the Schrodinger equation. Because what he showed analytically is that the solutions all match exactly what you're seeing. At that point, nobody was even sure exactly what psi meant. That took another 20 years. But they knew that there had to be something right about the equation. After all, the energy levels that are coming out, it matches experiments so well, it can't be an accident, really. Okay? Anyway, so that's a case where you can do things analytically. But then anytime you go to anything more complicated than a hydrogen atom, like helium even, or silicon, or solids, there are really no analytical solutions anymore. And the reason is that anything with more than one electron, what makes hydrogen relatively easy is the fact that there's only one electron. But if you have multiple electrons, then an important part of this potential is the potential that one electron feels due to all the other electrons, which themselves are kind of distributed in a way that you don't quite know to start with. And that's what makes this whole thing hard, and any solution you see is, at the end, approximate. It's really not a first, I mean, although even there are these first principles methods, it is really approximate in that sense, because you're solving a many electron problem, 1,000 electrons, million electrons, and what you're really saying is, let's assume that one electron sort of feels some average potential due to all the other ones, which is what is going in there. Right? That could come from Poisson equation or could come from something more sophisticated, all kinds of corrections that people have worked out. Okay. The bottom line is, what I'm trying to say is that differential equations are convenient for analytical solutions, but anytime you want to solve it numerically, you usually turn it into a matrix equation or what you might call a difference equation. And how to go from one to the other, that is something you should be very clear on. And that's the point I want to talk about. And one of the things we'll do, in the next homework I'll ask you to do, is, you know, set up a numerical solution here and show you that actually a wave packet, how it moves and how that velocity compares with this and things like that. Now, there's two forms, by the way, in which you see the Schrodinger equation usually. One is this one, which is what you call the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and this is what you'd call the time-independent Schrodinger equation. This is the time-dependent. Okay. Now, when can you go from one to the other? Well, one basic point about differential equations that I mentioned before is that if all the coefficients are constant in space and time, then you can always write the solution in the form of exponentials. So if, for example, this is a constant, then I don't really need a computer or anything at all. This solution to this can be written in the form of e to the power I k x, e to the power minus I e t over h bar. I mean, this e over h bar, you could think of as a frequency, sort of omega t. So any solution of this type will satisfy a differential equation as long as, you know, all the coefficients are constant. And the only thing then that you have to work out is the relationship between e and k. That is, for a given e, you need a particular k, and that's what's called the dispersion relation for that thing. So for example, here, if you substitute it in there, in this, what would happen is this exponential minus I e over h bar, because it has that form, taking its derivative is the equivalent of multiplying by minus I e over h bar. Anytime you have a solution looking like that, d dt simply means multiplying by that. Similarly, d dx simply means multiplying by ik. That's it. And so all the size just cancel out, and this is no longer a differential equation. It just becomes an algebraic equation at that point, because all these differential operators are just like multiplying with something. That's it. And so, and if you drop all that, what you get is E equals h bar squared k squared over 2m plus u0, which is what you then call the dispersion relation. So you'd end up with something like this. So this is what you'd call the dispersion relation corresponding to this differential equation. And the point is, you should be able to go back and forth between the two. Back and forth in the sense, if I gave you a differential equation like this, you should be able to figure out what the EK relationship is. Because all that happens is, as I said, instead of d dt, put that in. Instead of d dx, put this ik in, and you're there. That's it. And you should be able to go the other way also. You see? You could start from here. If I told you this is the differential equation, question is, what is the corresponding different? This is the dispersion relation. What is the corresponding differential equation? You should be able to go this way also. Just take the E, put I d dt from k, go I d dx, etc., and you're done. That's the thing, right? So, yeah. Now, usually we are often dealing with the time-independent Schrodinger equation, where the idea is that, well, if you have a problem where the coefficients actually vary in space, u of x, let's say, but they're still time independent, then what you can do is, what that means is, you can no longer write your solution in the form of exponential ikx, but you can still write it that way, as far as time goes, since nothing depends on time. The space part, you have to work on it. You don't know what it will be. That will depend on the details of the problem. Now you need a computer, or you have to have a good analytical solution. You have to work all that out. But as far as the time part is concerned, you could just assume that. And if you assume that, then what will happen is this left-hand side will simply become e times psi. Because again, as far as the time is concerned, it has the exponential form. So d dt simply means multiplying with that. And so this just becomes e phi. And then whatever operator we have here, this differential operator plus u, et cetera, we'll call that h. And so that's what I've written as e phi equals h phi. So this is a solution you can use whenever you're dealing with problems where the coefficients don't depend on with time. So if you're trying to solve a problem where, let's say, you have a solid where you're shining light on it, then you might actually need to go here. Or you're trying to figure out how a wave packet moves in time. You have something here, how does it move? Then you might need something like this. On the other hand, lots of times what we'll be talking about is current flow under steady state conditions. Nothing explicitly depending on time. And you can, most of the time, you're really working with this one. But you should see that, you know, it's basically going from one to the other is easy. It's just that here this psi is a function of x and t, but if nothing depends on time, then the time part of it can be written trivially as this. And then what you are left with is a differential equation for the spatial part. And that's what this is. Okay? Okay. Now, what I want to talk about then is the matrix version of this and how the two relate. So, what we have here is this E phi. Let's work with the time independent version, but whatever we're discussing applies just as well to this. You could work with any really, not a big deal. So, E phi equals H operator phi. So, I kind of, as a reminder, I put in OP here, because just to remind us that this is a differential operator we're talking about. Now, the matrix version of this, so that's the differential equation. You know, that H operator, it has got d2, dx2, things like that in it. Now, the matrix version of this would look something like so. So, what's happened here is, this phi, which was a function, this was like phi of x, or xyz in general, has become a column vector. Column vector means a list of numbers, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, etc. This is also a list column vector. And this, what was here, this differential operator, that has become a matrix. That's this. Okay? So this is the differential equation, and this is the equivalent matrix equation. And as I said, all numerical methods for solving differential equations, I think all probably, usually amount to first turning it into a matrix equation and then solving the matrix equation. Because once you have it this way, there are very powerful ways of solving finding the eigenvalues of that matrix and finding the eigenvectors. Right? And MATLAB is, of course, one of the best tools for doing that. All you have to do is, once you have set up the matrix, you give it the matrix, you come back giving you all the eigenvalues, eigenvectors, you're done. Okay? So the important part is how to get from here to there, for example. So now, what does this column vector represent? Take this off. So one way to think about it, and for the moment, let's just think of a one-dimensional thing. So I guess I'll write it here. But if you have, so this is x. So if you think of a little discrete lattice here. Now, of course, x is a continuous variable. But supposing we make a discrete lattice and say that x can only take on certain discrete values, like so, then any function psi of x can be represented by its values at those discrete points. So, I guess, I was using phi. So, any function phi of x. So, what you could do is take these values, you know, phi 1, phi 2, whatever it is, phi 3, phi 4, etc. And then if you list these numbers, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4, that's what that column vector is. That's one way of thinking about it. Okay? Now, a more general way of thinking about it, more general view is that what you're really doing is you're expanding phi of x in terms of a known set of functions. So you're writing it as phi m some known set of functions, which I'll write as u. So this is the function I do not know. And what I do is I expand it in terms of some set of functions I know. And these coefficients then are basically what form that column vector. Again, these are numbers. And this then would be a special case of this, because you could think of these u's as little rectangles around here, for example. So you could say that I'm taking the real function and representing it by a series of rectangles. And the phi's simply tell me the height of each rectangle, for example. Right? Now, whether it's a rectangle or there should be a better shape to it, I'm not getting into those issues. But roughly, you can see the idea. The basic point is that when I'm trying to solve for this function, I first set up a grid with points in it. And this idea of taking the function and expanding it in terms of what's called the basis functions, these are called the basis functions, that's kind of a generalization of that. It's a generalized way of writing a grid, in a way. Those basis functions are like your grid points, in a way. You know, as if it's little rectangles like this, each one of them. But these don't have to be little localized rectangles. For example, you could be expanding a function in a Fourier series, in which case these functions could be sine kx and cosine kx, in which case it's not little neat boxes like this, but something more abstract, right? But in some space, it's again boxes. It's just that it's not in real space. Okay? So this is the more general way of thinking about it, that how do you turn a differential equation in a matrix equation? Well, whatever you're looking for, expand it in a set of basis functions. And then these functions, these coefficients here, that's what this one is. This column vector, it tells you this complete list of these functions, these numbers. So these are just numbers. Now, this is a matrix equation. I could write it out in terms of its components. So, for example, I could write this as E phi n. So, that's the nth component of phi. Is equal to this matrix H times phi, and I need to write the nth component of the whole thing. Now, I've got... How do I write the nth component of a product of two things? Well, that's where this rule of matrix multiplication tells me I can write it this way. H n m phi m summed over m. Because that's the rule for matrix multiplication. You see, this whole thing is like the nth component of H phi. That's how you multiply two matrices, or a matrix and a column vector. Okay. So that's the original differential equation. You use basis functions to turn it into a matrix equation. And a matrix equation is really just a set of algebraic equations like this. Set of them. Okay. Now, if you have a uniform solid, so let me think of, like, you have this x, and I've broken it up into little discrete points. Now, question is, what does this HNM look like? HNM, that's the elements of that matrix. Now, so let me write out the full matrix a little bit here. Or... Let actually to write out the matrix, it would have looked something like this. So this would be the H matrix. So if you actually wrote out the full matrix, it would have looked something like this. And that amounts to saying, okay, E phi n is equal to H n m times phi m, and you sum that way, and that's what you're talking about. Okay. Now the question is, then, what do you expect that matrix H to look like? And what it would generally look like in a uniform solid, what you'd expect is that every line should look about the same. Why? Because, well, if I stand anywhere, that's this point n, and you're saying E phi n is equal to H n m times phi m. Sum over m. So at any point, E times the wave function at that point is equal to H n m times various wave functions at different points. Now, and the thing is, if instead of here, I moved here, you'd expect these H's to remain much the same, as long as it's a uniform solid. No matter where you go, the environment looks much the same. And that's the equivalent of saying, like earlier what I said about a differential equation, namely, if you have constant coefficients for a differential equation. So the equivalent of having a constant set of coefficients is like having every line look much the same. So the simplest case you can think of is where each line looks like this. It's like there's some epsilon on the diagonal, and the next one over is some number t. Next one over is some number t. Like this. So, and everything else is zero. This is like the simplest thing you can think of. Something on the diagonal, just some number here, nothing else, that's it. And what I want to show is, what we want to discuss is, well, what would the corresponding dispersion relation look like if you had a matrix like this? Because earlier what I said is, if you have a differential equation, when you had a differential equation like this, the corresponding thing was E equals H bar square K square over 2M plus U0, as long as the U was constant. And what I'm now saying is, well, let's say we have figured out a matrix version of this. Question is, what would the different E versus K look like for a matrix version, and how would this compare? And the reason I'm doing that is that often the way it works, there's this two, you know, how do I find this matrix? Well, there's this two approaches people use. One is what you might call a first principles approach, where you actually start from Schrodinger equation, do certain integrals, and find out what these numbers are. That's one approach, right, which I'm not going into. There is the other approach, which is what you call the semi-empirical approach, which is where you'd say, well, I know that electrons in a conduction band have an EK relation like this. So my question is, what kind of a matrix should I use so that I get an EK relation that looks much like what it should be? And then you can go on with this matrix and do more complicated things with it, like calculate current flow and all that stuff. But first step is, you say, okay, we know that in this material, E versus K should look like this. So let me use a matrix that will give me an EK relation like that. Okay? Now, of course, you could be talking about really small things like a hydrogen molecule, in which case there is no EK relation. We're just talking of something very small. In that case, we're just talking of, say, some small matrix like this. And then you directly try to get these parameters so that they match the known facts about the hydrogen molecule, for example. So this is what you'd call the semi-empirical approach, where you are taking these elements of the matrix, so that they are in keeping with all the known facts about the material, so that you can then go on to do other things. Whereas an entire field of research that you generally call electronic structure theory would be where you actually start from Schrödinger equation, try to find what these numbers should be, compare them with experiment, try to figure out if it's really working, if not, how to improve the theory, and so on. That's what you generally call electronic structure theory, right? Which we are not getting into. What we are talking about here is, okay, how do I choose this set of parameters so that it more or less describes the material, and then so that we can talk about other things that we want to talk about, which is the current flow and things like that. Okay. Now, so my question then is, supposing we had a material whose this H looks like this, what would its dispersion relation be? And the way you can write that is, well, just as here, as long as everything's uniform, the solution can be written in the form of e to the power ikx. And when you substitute that in here, you get the ek relation. Here also it works somewhat similarly. I could say that, let me write that here, e phi n is equal to summation over m h n m phi m. And so in this case, assuming that the matrix looks like this, you could write this as, can you help me? Like, there should be only three terms, right? Because e phi n is equal to, I'm just going down this row, everything is zero except for these three. So when I multiply this into this, I should get only three terms. And epsilon will multiply the diagonal term, which means if this is phi n, epsilon will multiply phi n. Now, can you tell me what the t's will multiply? T phi n minus 1 and t phi n plus 1. That's it. So in this case, that's what it would be. And the solutions can be written as phi n is equal to e to the power I k n a, a being this distance. So n a is like the x coordinate of the nth point. So it's just like this, e to the power I k x n. Now, how do I know this will work? Now, this is a point I often make, that with differential equations, usually it's not like an algebraic equation. It's not like you solve it. What I mean is, in algebraic equations, we are used to doing things like that if x plus 1 is equal to 2, then x is equal to 2 minus 1 equals 1. So the solution follows in a logical way. Whereas with differential equations, it's really not like there's a logical way to come at the solution. It's more like if you try a certain solution, see if it works, right? And over the years, what people have done is built up an entire catalog of solutions so that when you see something that has this form, you know, okay, the Legendre polynomial should satisfy, say, this class of equations, or LaGuardia polynomial should satisfy that class of equations, and so on. And the simplest thing, of course, is like what I mentioned, that when coefficients are constant, just simple exponentials will satisfy it. That's one of the simplest. So the point I'm trying to make is, with differential equations, if you haven't seen it before, it's hard to tell exactly what the solution is. But if I claim that this is the solution, in about 5 minutes, you should be able to tell me whether I'm right or not. Because you could always take that, substitute it back in there, and see if it works. So just here, I said that, as long as it's a constant, this should work. Well, substitute it in here and see if it works. And you could tell me. Now, I couldn't quite explain how I know this. That I know from because of all the catalog of solutions that people have. That's how I know it, really. But you can tell me whether but you don't have to take my word that this is right. You could always put it in and check for yourself. Okay? And the same here. That it's not like offhand you have this entire infinite set of different algebraic equations. it's hard to see immediately what can I write down so that it would actually satisfy all of them. In general, you'd have to go to a computer to solve this, right? Because there could be hundreds of these algebraic equations. So you have to solve it in general. But here, because every line looks the same, it's this T epsilon and T everywhere. That's why a solution like this will automatically satisfy this entire set of algebraic equations. Yeah.
So
the original Schrodinger equation, I should remind you, that mass is the free electron mass. Whereas what we are using here is strictly not a, what I've written down here is when you apply it to a solid, is strictly not a Schrodinger equation. What you should call it is an effective mass equation. And that is this idea that in this material, because of all the complicated calculations and experiments that people have done over the years, they believe that electrons in this energy range have a EK relation that looks something like this, with the M given by a certain effective mass. And since this differential equation also has that, we think that electrons in that energy range, in that solid, could be described by this differential equation. So when we call it Schrodinger equation, it's really in a loose sense. You should really call it the effective mass equation. But here what we are talking about right now is more or less, is not so much to do with physics as just plain math. That if this is a differential equation, that's the solution and that's the dispersion relation. Regardless of what problem you're doing. And same here. If you have a difference equation like this, I claim this is the solution. And what I'd like to do next is put this in here and find the equivalent of this. Just as here we had this relationship, question is, in a difference equation, what is it? Okay. Someone had a question. Yeah.
For materials that are far deviate the band fraction from the parabolic approximation, can one write down an effective equation?
Right. So one of the questions, right, supposing you have some non-parabolic term, let's say alpha k to the power 4, for example, then the corresponding differential equation would have a fourth derivative, right? Del 4 phi del x 4. Okay? So if you wanted to do something with this, you would use a differential equation looking like that. And people have done that, right? And in some materials where you have significant non-parabolicity, I believe they've done that compared against experiment. Looks like it works in those cases, yes. Now, in general, things can be a little more complicated than this, because here what we are talking about is a single band effective mass equation. There are some cases like valence bands where you have to consider multiple bands, and that gets a little more complicated, which we'll talk about after this, later on. At this time, what we're doing is the single band version. Okay. So, in this, if you had a differential equation like this, a difference equation like this, and the way you visualize this is like the diagonal element, you can write here, and this T and that T, this tells you the connection between the N and the N plus 1. So the connection between the N and the N plus 1, that's this T, and the connection between N and N minus 1, that's the other T. So, this matrix that I just erased kind of had that information with epsilons and t's like this here. And in general, though, it is not very convenient to be writing that matrix. In 1D, you can at least write it. In 2D, that matrix gets messy to write. But it's much better if you can visualize that just with this picture. In a picture like this, epsilon on the diagonal, t to this and t to that. And that really implies that differential equation implies this set of equations. Right? So if you can go from here to here without writing that matrix, that's much more convenient. Someone had a question.
Here in each row, we are taking the diagonal elements E and off diagonal, so two terms only. So is it because the nearest neighbor?
Right. So this is what you'd call the nearest neighbor model.
But what I'm about to discuss, though, doesn't depend on that. What I'm about to discuss would be fine as long as every row looks the same. So you could put a T prime here. It would just make the algebra a little longer, but we'll talk about that. So it's not essential for what we are discussing. But the example I took with just epsilon on the diagonal, so this is n, this is n, this is n minus 1, this is n plus 1, and then it zeros everywhere else. That's what you'd call the nearest neighbor model, in the sense that you only have non-zero coupling to the nearest neighbors and not beyond that. But as I said, what we're discussing would apply in general. Main thing is every row should look the same. So when you go to the next row, the epsilon moves over, the T moves over, that T moves over, but then rest is all zero. But every row looks the same, just moved over. That's the thing, yeah. No, usually it goes down in most models. Right. If you actually had calculated it directly from Schrodinger equation with basis functions and all that, you should usually go down further and further. And most models, people would, I think most models tend to be nearest neighbor. There are some next nearest neighbor. I haven't seen anything that, or I guess there are the first principles models often have up to maybe seventh or eighth neighbors also. So they do have long range things that you sometimes include. But if it's a semi-empirical model, then you don't really like to have that many parameters around. So you try to get it with just one or just nearest neighbor or next nearest neighbor. Okay. Now, if you accept this, then you'll know what I want to do from here is get a relationship between E and K. So phi n is equal to this. So let me divide through by phi n like this. Now, so this one just cancels out. That's easy. So what is this? Phi n minus 1 divided by phi n? See, e to the power I k n minus 1, and then e to the power I k n. So when you divide it, you'll get e to the power minus I k a. And on the other side, you'll get e to the power plus I k a. So overall, you'll get epsilon plus 2t cosine k a. So in this case, this is what you'd get. Now, what you can convince yourself is, like we are saying, what if it didn't stop with the next neighbor but went on one more? Well, what would have happened then is you'd have got a term 2t prime. And can you help me? What would the factor be? Do you see it? Yeah. You see, you'd then have a term that would look like plus t prime phi n minus 2 over phi n. And then another one here, t prime phi n plus 2 over phi n. And of course, these ratios would have e to the power I 2 k a instead of I k a. And so you'd end up with a 2 t prime cosine 2 k a. And if you had more, you could include them also. Not an issue. Okay? But for this discussion here, let's just stick to this. So what that means is if you had a complicated shape for an e k, you could always fit it with, maybe if not with a nearest neighbor, at least a few more nearest neighbor, few more neighbors, and you could do it in general. Okay. Now my question is, how does that compare to this? So this is the differential equation. That's the dispersion relation. And that's the difference equation, and the corresponding dispersion relation is this. And the question is, are those similar, same? Can we make them look the same? Now, if you plot it, what you'd see is, you see, this one would look something like this. It would go like a cosine function. Whereas this one, that's a parabola. So that would look something like this. And if I adjusted my parameters correctly, I could make this part match reasonably well. And so as long as I'm talking about electrons that are in this energy range, those two models would be equivalent and should give me same results. So instead of solving the differential equation, I should be able to solve the difference equation. Yeah. Yeah. So the way I have drawn it, that's what you'd get if T is negative. If T is positive, you tend to get something that goes the other way, which would be more like a valence band type of thing, things that is going downwards. Okay? This you can think about. Now, the way you see the correspondence mathematically is to say something like this, that, you see, I have E equals epsilon plus 2t cosine ka. Now, for small ka, cosine can be written as 1 minus k squared a squared over 2. Yes, for small x, cosine x is 1 minus x squared over 2. And so, I could write this as epsilon plus 2t minus t a squared times k squared. So what I did was, I took this cosine thing, and I'm doing what you might call a Taylor series expansion, or this. So this is really approximate. This is approximate. And that should describe my function fairly well down here. That's where the cosine x, you can think of it that way. And so you end up with this. And now you see, I can compare with what I had here. You know, this is like a constant plus something times k squared. This is also a constant plus something times k squared. And the way I could make the two correspond is if I choose epsilon plus 2t as equal to u0 and minus t a squared as equal to h bar square over 2m. I could take the a square from here, put it there. If I choose this way, then you see the cosine will look just like the parabola. Okay? So bottom line, to sum up what we kind of talked about today is, okay, here's the differential equation. If you, for a, like some effective mass m, if you're solving this differential equation, you'd have got something like this. And the solutions would look like e to the power I k x. What we'll be using a lot is the difference equation. This is where you think of an electron as being on some kind of a discrete lattice like this, let's say. And conceptually, as I said, the way to think about it is as if you have taken your wave function and expanded it in some set of basis functions. And so now, instead of a wave function, you just ask for what are the coefficients of those basis functions. That's what you, and that's what this matrix equation is about. Okay. Now, the solution to that matrix equation, what I was showing you was a simple example, also can be written as exponentials and gives you an EK relationship of this type. And this would match this if you choose your parameters this way. So there's two ways. So one way to think of it is, if this is the equation you believe in, and you say, okay, now I want to do things numerically. So what do we do? Well, we set up a discrete lattice, choose our parameters epsilon and t so as to satisfy these relations, and we go on from there. And then if a problem actually has a U that is changing with X, then you could make your epsilon also change with X. What that means is you could make the diagonal elements be a little different as you go along. You could have one thing here, have a little something a little different here, something a little different here, and that would then describe having an electric field in there, for example, if you want to do that. Of course, you don't have a different, don't have a dispersion relation anymore. But the thing is, yeah, this is the correspondence you need to have in order to have those two things give you equivalent results. Now, and in what we'll talk about more is after this. So, for example, you could use this to set up a lattice and see how a wave packet moves. You could solve, because once you have a matrix equation, you can use MATLAB to just set up an initial wave function, see how it evolves with time, for example. That's what I'll describe to you next day. And we'll, yeah, go on. Let me stop here today.